From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. The longest-running original series on Netflix is coming to an end. Grace and Frankie has run for 7 seasons, telling raunchy and honest stories of older women. Marta Kaufman co-created Friends and Grace and Frankie, which made it to an unheard-of 94 episodes, on a service that's been offering more and more shows, even as it drops many scripted series after a couple of seasons. She's not surprised that the big-volume approach has led to problems.
We're going to do a little bit of everything in the hopes that there'll be a niche audience for every show. And there isn't a niche audience for every single show.
Kaufman talks about the challenges of making 10 seasons of Friends and whether she thinks the content bubble is bursting. But first we banter. Stick around. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my buddy in banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So I did a story recently that was very illuminating for me, and apparently a lot of people in the community, in the business, were very happy to read it based on the emails and texts and calls I've been getting. And it was about Netflix, which has been topic A for a little bit now as they've run into troubles. For a long time, Matt, as you well know, Netflix was like a little bit culty and a black box. You signed on to work there. They paid you a lot of money if you were an executive. And you did not talk about the company. And people were truly paranoid about breaking that rule. You know, it was just very, very difficult to get a read. But now we're at this moment of drama where Netflix has hit this very big speed bump, if that's what it is. And people are in this soul-searching, reflecting mood. And the main thing that people said to me, and I'm talking about creators as well as people who have been with Netflix for years, is they feel a fork in the road was reached when Ted Sarandos fired Cindy Holland. Ted Sarandos, the co-CEO, at the time he was chief content officer. This was in September 2020. Cindy Holland was the executive behind the first originals that came out of the gate so strong, you know, House of Cards, Orange is the New Black, Stranger Things, and on from there. I mean, she had some expensive misses and she was known to be spendy, but her hits were water cooler shows. And, you know, this was up through Queen's Gambit. At that point, Netflix pivoted to this new strategy. And a lot of these people that I talked to felt like a lot of things changed for the worse.
Right. And that strategy has been to increase the volume of the fire hose. They are producing more content. They're producing more global content that is made specifically for other countries or designed to be on a global scale. And it has delivered a few hits. Something like Squid Game, I think, probably wouldn't have been possible under the previous regime. But it has also contributed to at least the perception, and I believe the reality, that Netflix is not focused as much on quality and that they are really just focused on, you know, getting something out there for everyone in all the demos. And you cited a couple of great examples in your story of, you know, shows that were actually passed on by certain executives at Netflix, but then were resurrected by the new regime, and it was designed to be more populist and broader. You can do that when you are the darling of Wall Street and your stock keeps going up, up, up. But Netflix has lost about 2/3 of its value in the past 6 months. And when that happens, people start to look closely under the hood, and they're looking right now, and what they're finding is a real question as to whether this is the best strategy.
Yeah, I mean, we have our guest today, Marta Kaufman, talking about that experience of, you know, with all the competition, which has definitely been a factor in Netflix's problems with the new streamers, HBO Max, Disney Plus, et cetera, coming on. She talks about that experience of looking at the TV and finding nothing to watch. And now Netflix is cutting off these shows at a couple of seasons. And as you will hear, she thinks that is not a way to engage audiences, to develop a relationship with the characters. I don't know if it's working for Netflix, but they are losing subscribers, and they're expecting to lose 2 million in the current quarter. And something is contributing to that. And I do think it's overload. As I wrote in the story for The Hollywood Reporter, people are overwhelmed and underwhelmed by the Netflix offerings.
Yeah. And a lot of these iconic series that have really driven the demand for, you know, the lean back, just watch a few episodes of your favorite show experience, those are owned by other companies and they are taking them back. I mean, we know about Friends and The Office. Those are the famous examples. But just this week, Schitt's Creek, the very popular show that really became a thing on Netflix, even though it was originated in Canada, that show is moving from Netflix to Hulu. And you're seeing increased competition from these other streamers and they're taking back their content, leaving Netflix to kind of live and die on its originals. You got to constantly sell them on new shows.
Yes, as made clear by Warner Brothers Discovery's chief David Zaslav when he did an earnings call this week, you know, don't we look good? We're diversified. All the schadenfreude about Netflix from these legacy companies is like, hey, it hurts us too. Our stock is down because of the panic now on Wall Street. Is streaming really the end all and be all? But at the same time, they are so happy, first of all, that they have other things that they can sell to people. And second of all, they don't care for Netflix because as every single conversation I talked to anybody about this, the word arrogance was used. The arrogance of how Netflix carried itself as the legacy studio killer, poaching executives willy-nilly, paying them millions and millions of dollars. All of these things just infuriated the competition and in many cases, creators.
Yeah, there's been a perception that Netflix has been playing a different game for the past 5 to 7 years, and they have been declaring themselves winners across the entire universe of Hollywood when there's been no accountability as to the spending and as to some of the strategic decisions that they've made. And now there is accountability, and I think there's accountability across the entire industry. I had someone text me the other day saying, wow, it's finally cool to own linear television networks again. And it's kind of true, because those at least throw off millions and millions of dollars in cash that can be used to invest in these other businesses. Netflix has really survived on taking on debt to invest in this business, and it's been rewarded by the stock market. But if that's not the case, they've really got to justify themselves.
Yeah, and of course, they're in crisis mode right now. And I'm sure we'll see layoffs and grinding of budgets. You know, they're already making creators crazy. That used to be, here's your money, go make your show. And now it's like, that's too much, and it's not good for the algorithm. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, founding partner of Puck News. The comedy Grace and Frankie launched on Netflix in 2015, a long ago era in streaming television. Jane Fonda plays Grace, an uptight and waspy former cosmetics mogul, while Lily Tomlin is Frankie, a caftan-wearing, free-spirited artist. The two women never really liked each other, but they're brought together when their husbands, played by Martin Sheen and Sam Waterston, tell them at dinner that they want to get married to each other.
You mean you're gay? And this is who you're gay with?
This is who I'm in love with.
God. No, this makes no sense. You're business partners. You're not lovers. Friends. How long has this been going on?
Well, it's been, I don't know exactly, 20 years.
You don't think there was a better time to tell us this? Like, say, any time over the last 2 decades?
I'm gonna throw up.
Grace and Frankie showrunner Marta Kaufman became television royalty in the 90s as co-creator of NBC's Friends. That sitcom aired from 1994 to 2004, one of the most successful TV shows of all time. Grace and Frankie is the longest-running original show on Netflix, but the streamer decided season 7 would be its last, and the final shows have just been released. You have got 94 episodes of this show. Right?
I know, right?
And I have to make a confession. I have watched this show for a long time. And still to this day, I'm like, is it Grace and Frankie or Frankie and Grace?
That's so funny. So many people do that.
It's not just me. I feel better.
Yeah. It's counterintuitive because of the alphabet.
Yes, yes. So 94 episodes. You're like, you're a unicorn, right? Is anybody going to have 94 episodes of anything on Netflix?
You know, probably not. I mean, they tend, at least at this point in their thinking, to do only 3 seasons primarily of shows.
At most.
So
at most. Yeah.
Right. We got in at the very beginning.
Right.
When they were just starting to do original series. And we had incredible support and I think more success than they had anticipated.
Yes, It's almost like, you know, we're just speaking as the Netflix stock drop has happened and they lost subscribers for the first time in years. You were there. They came out of the gate so strong, almost, really, with House of Cards and Orange is the New Black and Stranger Things and your show, that I'm sure they must have thought, I mean, maybe it wasn't even a good thing for them, because maybe they just thought, we so have this, you know, it's just everything worked early on.
Yeah, and it drew people to the shows because they were characters you could invest in. I think part of what happens is people don't connect in the same way with shows where they know there's only going to be a season or two seasons. You don't want to get too attached.
Right. It's an emotional thing where, you know, you just think these people are going to leave me, I think, right?
Right. Exactly. And I also think they threw a very wide net, and it may have been too wide.
You mean, you know, just trying to be everything to everyone?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. We're going to do a little bit of everything in the hopes that there'll be a niche audience for every show. And there isn't a niche audience for every single show.
Yeah, it's this whole thing of the streaming wars has been, you know, I mean, I have to say, I've been watching it and I'm not so surprised to see this, because I just felt like this whole game of trying to spend and spend and spend for fresh stuff all the time is like a suicide pact, you know?
Exactly. And there's something too overwhelming about it, I think. Mm-hmm. How can I go to turn on TV and feel like I have nothing to watch?
Yeah.
How is that even possible? Mm-hmm. There are 64,000 shows.
Wow.
And yet there are those days where I just look at it and go, nah, there's nothing here for me.
Well, there's so many aspects of this, but I'm gonna take a minute and step back, and I almost feel bad doing it, to talk about Friends, because I feel like you cannot do an interview without talking about Friends, and I apologize for that.
I never mind talking about it.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that. Remind me, how many episodes of Friends were there?
236.
So those were the old days.
Those were the old days, yeah. That was not only 10 seasons, but we did basically 24 episodes a year, a season.
That's crazy, isn't it? Do you look back and think, how did we ever?
I do. I look back at it often and think, how did we get through it, number one? How did I do it with kids, number two?
Oh, my God.
I can't figure that out. But yeah, I can't imagine. We did 13 episodes and were exhausted on Grace and Frankie. 24, it's like, we used to say it was like Indiana Jones and the ball chasing him through the cave.
Yeah.
That's the ball was production. And we were just trying not to get rolled over.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, it's funny with going back to the Netflix thing, Friends gave Netflix life to a great degree, because it was on, and they got it. It was Warner show, as despite the many children in the world now who think it's a Netflix show.
Right.
And those shows, part of what's happened with Netflix is Friends and The Office and those giant 200-episode whatever shows.
Right.
Even when Netflix was in its, you know, having the better originals, those were the things that people tended to watch, I think.
Well, it goes back to what you were saying before. I mean, yes, those shows are off the air, and those were shows where if there was nothing else to watch and you wanted some comfort food, that's where you went.
Yes.
So I think them losing those Netflix losing those shows was a crushing loss for them.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to roll even further back before Friends. Your origin story, you met your longtime partner, David Crane, at Brandeis, I think.
That's correct. Yes. We were actually both acting in a production of Camino Real, and I played a whore and he played a street urchin, and that was how we met.
That was it. You were on the same social plane. It was cast. You were cast within the cast.
That's right.
So you had a very long time partnership, and you had talked in an interview I read somewhere about sexism that you encountered in your career. And you told this story about having cramps.
Yes. We were shooting an episode of Friends, and there's an area of the stage, the front of the stage in front of the audience, where we have these monitors where we can see all four cameras. And I was watching a scene and I had my notebook in my left hand and my pen in my right, and I was bent over and I was writing down some notes. And a big shot from Warner Brothers asked me if I was okay. And I said, I was fine. He said, no, really, what's wrong? And I said, really, I'm okay. And he said, but you're in pain. I said, yes, I have cramps. And he said, this is why I hate to hire women.
Wow. I mean, that's some, that it's your show.
You know, and I'm standing there doing my work. You know, I may be bleeding from the vagina, but no one knows that.
Yes. And he, that's his takeaway with it, what I assume was one of his biggest hit shows.
That, if not his biggest hit show.
Coming up after a short break, Marta Kaufman sees big challenges ahead for TV writers. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. The blossoming friendship between Jane Fonda's Grace and Lily Tomlin's Frankie is the heart of the show Grace and Frankie, which just released its final episodes. The show, which at this point has four octogenarian lead actors, offers a frank and sometimes raunchy take on the lives of women and men of a certain age. The series has touched on many subjects mostly ignored by television, and no issue has been off limits.
And I mean, shouldn't older women have it better than that?
Couldn't we fight for the right to masturbate after lunch?
Seriously, Mom, how do I explain to my children that their grandma makes sex toys for other grandmas?
I'll tell you what you can tell them, honey. We're making things for people like us because we are sick and tired of being dismissed by people like you.
Mic drop. Let's go home.
Series co-creator and showrunner Marta Kaufman is also the co-creator of Friends, along with her former writing partner, David Crane. That series wrapped in 2004, and Grace and Frankie premiered in the spring of 2015. So you then have this amazing experience of the success of Friends, and then you move on to this show, Grace and Frankie. See, I did it right this time.
Thank you.
Non-alphabetical order. And is it your first show of yours, the first thing you've done in a long time, right, with no David Crane?
Correct. Yeah.
How was that?
You know, it was an interesting process because after Friends, we wanted to do different things. He is, to this day, still one of my dearest friends. He's like a brother to me. Everything is very good between us. We just wanted to go do different things. And the first thing I had to do was learn how to write alone. He was always at the keyboard. I did what I used to call writing out loud.
So when he was typing, were you voicing Monica and
yes.
Chandler?
Oh, yeah. We acted out. It was almost like improvisation sometimes, where one of us would say something for one character and the other person would respond as another character. And we would find ourselves going back and forth like that. But he was always at the keyboard.
Did you guys do any character, or did you tend to be, I don't know?
No, we did just about any character. On Grace and Frankie, I generally was Grace.
Well, who was we in that context?
The writer's room.
Okay, got it.
In the writer's room. And we would, after we finished a scene, we always read it out loud.
So you were Grace in the writer's room, and which I would have somehow imagined you as a Frankie.
I know, right?
Right.
I'm definitely more of a Frankie, and yet I always did Grace.
You're like, I can be this Shiksa goddess person.
Exactly. Exactly. It was a great fantasy.
Right. So I had read that you had sort of randomly paired Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin because you heard they were wanting to do TV, but
right.
You thought they meant together.
That's correct.
So
that's correct. And I ran after this lunch where I heard they wanted to do TV. I ran and called my agent and said, is it true they want to do TV together? And she said, I don't know, I'll call you back. And 20 minutes later, she calls me back and she says, they do now.
That is definitely some kismet there.
Right?
Yeah. Was there a big, I don't know, were they friends before? Did they know each other?
Yeah, I mean, they certainly knew each other from 9 to 5, but they have remained friends.
Right. How could I forget? Yeah.
They have remained good friends over the years. I mean, their TV shows they would watch together, and they're hilarious with each other. I mean, they take really good care of each other. They have each other's backs, and they give each other a lot of in the best way, in a way only a friend can.
Right.
And it's wonderful to see. I mean, they have a beautiful relationship.
So when you find, when this becomes a yes, you don't have the concept in your head. You're looking for a thing that will work for them.
Correct. Correct. When they said yes, we were like, all right, now we need an idea. And we started talking about several ideas, but my daughter, who works in my company, is the one who said, what if there are two women who don't like each other and their husbands get married?
Yeah, that's something like a kid would come up with, a younger
right?
person, I think, right?
So that was that. And then we started developing it, and we would talk to them about their experiences as being older women. And we would pitch and share our ideas. And then when we got to a place where everybody was happy, we started pitching to the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we had two places that wanted it. But the idea at the time, you know, was the beginning of Netflix. And the idea of, if they like your script, you jump straight to 13 episodes. None of this, we're going to do a pilot and test it on audiences and make changes based on what audiences feel. No, you jump into 13 episodes and the learning curve is fast because you don't have a pilot.
Mm. So would you ever consider or try or think of going back to broadcast TV after this kind of an experience?
Yeah, I would.
Short answer.
I would. Look, you have to choose your place based on your show. So I can't say I will never do broadcast again because, you know, what if there's a show that would be perfect for broadcast?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I've done broadcast, so I understand the limitations and don't feel hamstrung by them. I understand them. You can't say the word, you know, you just
right.
can't do it. But truthfully, you don't need to.
Mm-hmm. I mean, is there a way for you to sum up this says broadcast to me versus streamer?
Yes. But it's the perspective of a writer.
Okay.
The biggest difference is you are forced in broadcast to fit into a box, meaning you have this many minutes before the main title. You have this many minutes before your first commercial break. You have this many minutes before your second commercial break. You have this many minutes before your third commercial break. And then you do your tag. And that's not always organic. The wonderful thing about streaming is here, you have your 30 minutes. Now figure out what the story is. And I don't have to worry about, oh my God, I need an act break. People have to want to come back after the commercial. You don't have to worry about any of those external pressures.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the biggest difference I felt between the two.
But you still somehow would get back into the sort of more structured system of broadcast because, I don't know, because it's reach, because it's, I mean, it almost feels, and we talked to Liz Merriweather after New Girl and
she's
doing,
my next door neighbor, by the way.
Oh, well, wave.
Hi, Liz.
And then she talked about The Dropout and, you know, she seemed to feel that broadcast was, you know, hard and not as easy to navigate. I mean, not easy is the wrong word, but, you know, more so many constraints.
You know,
time pressure, move. I mean, I'm sure you have to move along with Netflix or a streamer, too, but, you know, break.
Seriously, you really have to do that in any single camera when you have a certain number of days to shoot it in. You've got to make it producible. She may have had a different experience on The Dropout because it wasn't under the same kind of production time constraints. That's very possible.
Well, she ran into the pandemic, which also changed things. Yeah,
right. As did we. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You did, too. And you have older talent. So I guess that made things
yes,
difficult.
It was very scary. And it actually, we stopped in the middle of doing our fifth episode, and it took us almost 2 years to finish the fifth episode.
Wow. That's crazy. Oh my God. So I had understood that it was Netflix's decision to end the series now.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, is that a symptom, you think? I mean, I've been doing some reporting on this because of all the news around Netflix. You know, I hear that they've been, for the past year or more, tougher on budgets. And, you know, it used to be like, here's our lure. It will say yes, and then it's your show. I don't know if that was true for your, at least,
yes,
early
it was.
Experience.
It was.
And then it changed, but I don't know if it changed for you or not.
You know, we have seen it become more corporate,
mm-hmm.
and less about the artistic side. We've seen that happen. Luckily, we were not a problem child.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of the 7 years, you know, it was the right timing. So it didn't feel like the guillotine was coming down on the show. It just felt like a natural progression.
Yeah, I read that back in, this was in January 2020, back in the days when we still had no idea what was coming. You already said in an interview, I worry about the bubble bursting. And I assumed,
yeah,
you know, that was the content bubble.
Yes.
You think this is it?
Yes.
That's not what the town wants to hear.
I know, but I do. I think, you know, it's part of what's happening is everything is becoming so much more corporate. So the rules that Liz Merriweather was talking about in broadcast TV, there are now some of those rules coming to the streamers. So, you know, this is the kind of show we want. And for me, this is an old network habit. Here's a show that does really well. We want our Ted Lasso, or we want our, you know, fill in the blank, whatever is a huge success right now.
Right.
Rather than thinking, what's the next thing?
Mm-hmm.
It's as if everyone believes there's a formula and only that formula will work.
Right. Which is very old guard. Yeah, that's how it was.
It's very old guard. It is. And you know, I'm finding right now it's a really hard time to sell. The pandemic didn't help us when a lot of things that were bought hadn't gotten made.
Right. There's stockpile now. Yeah.
Yeah, there's this huge backlog. So nobody's buying anything so quickly. And we're seeing that viewers are getting frustrated.
Yeah, it's going to be, I guess we're looking at some lean years for the creative community. And
I am afraid that is true. And it's also, you know, this one of the other differences in the streaming is the order number. And it's making it very hard for people to make a good living because, you know, writers are getting 10 episodes here or 13 episodes there, or what they're now calling mini rooms, which I think are ridiculous. But then they have to get another job.
Yes.
After those 10 or 13 episodes, and people are working far less in the course of a year than they were before.
Right. Well, Marta Kaufman is the executive producer and showrunner of Netflix's longest running original series, Grace and Frankie, not Frankie and Grace. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
And that's the business. Melissa Yeager-Miller produced and edited today's program with help this week from Paul Smith, who mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.